This is Gloria Minot Presents.
Joining me right now is John Franklin. He's Director of Partnership and International Programs at the Smithsonian Institution's National Museum of African American History and Culture. We're going to be talking about not only the museum, but his illustrious ancestor. The book on his ancestor is titled My Life and an Era, the Autobiography of Buck Colbert Franklin. Good morning and welcome to the program. How are you?
Good morning. Quite well. So such a pleasure to be on your show.
Oh, it's just a pleasure to have you. You know, you snuck off, went to a very, very important event, which we're all proud of. But first, your ancestor. Buck Colbert Franklin, 1879 to 1960, led an extraordinary life from his youth in what was then Indian Territory to his practice of law in 20th century Tulsa. He was a witness to changes in politics, law, and race relations which transformed the Southwest. Would you tell us about your ancestor?
Certainly. I had the pleasure of knowing him my first 8 years of life. He indeed came to D.C. when I was born in 1952 to see this new grandson.
Yes.
But I started going to Tulsa when I was two. My father had been in high school in Tulsa, and prior to that he'd been born in a little all-black town called Rentersville, which my grandfather had moved to at the beginning of the 20th century. Our family on my father's side gets to Oklahoma in the 1830s, indeed, when it's Indian Territory, after the American Indian Removal Act by Congress of 1830. And native people from the Southeast were rounded up, and some of them had intermarried with African Americans, and others of the so-called Five Civilized Tribe had enslaved people living with them. My family was in the latter category. We were slaves to a Chickasaw family called the Birneys, B-U-R-N-E-Y or B-I-R-N-E-Y. And so we followed them to Indian Territory in the mid-1830s, and my grandfather's father and his people become established as black cowboys and ranchers working for the Birney family. My great-grandfather, David Birney, runs off to fight for the Union forces during the Civil War in the 1860s and changes his name to Franklin and frees himself. And so we've been Franklins only since the 1860s. And David Franklin then has seven or eight children. I've seen disputed numbers. One of whom, the middle child, is Buck Colbert, my grandfather, born, as you said, in 1879. And he's the first person in the family to go to college. He first learns to be a black cowboy, and he's roping and taking cattle to market in Kansas and Colorado. But he clearly shows great promise, and they send him off to prep school. He's born in southern Oklahoma in Hennepin and grows up in Paul's Valley. And he then goes off to college. His parents are taxpayers in Oklahoma, but they cannot go to the University of Oklahoma, which at that time is for white males only. So in the fall of 1899, he goes to Nashville and becomes a student, an undergraduate at Roger Williams University, a black Baptist, historically black college that no longer exists, where he meets my grandmother to be Molly Parker. And while they are in college, they study with a man named John Hope, who my grandfather will follow from Roger Williams to Atlanta Baptist, which we now know as Morehouse. And Grandpa Franklin graduates in the class of 1903. While they're in college, petroleum is discovered in Indian Territory, and these Native and African American people who've been given land that's relatively worthless compared to the land they occupied and lived on in the East Coast near the ocean, near the rivers and the mountains, all of a sudden is producing petroleum. And so many Native and African American people have become people of means due to this oil wealth. And my grandfather decides to become an attorney to be, among other things, a mediator between the oil companies and these Native and African American peoples in the negotiations with the petroleum companies. Black Wall Street develops around Tulsa. Tulsa becomes the oil capital of the world, and Black Tulsa, known as Greenwood, becomes known as Black Wall Street, and it has banks and businesses and oil leasing companies and hotels and theaters and nightclubs and churches and schools, which become the object of both envy and are then the night of May 30th to June 1st destroyed, looted, destroyed, and burned with bombs from airplanes. This is called the Tulsa Race Riot, which we now increasingly refer to as the Tulsa Massacre or the Tulsa Pogrom, because it is ethnic cleansing in the United States. And this community is burned to the ground in 24 hours. Prosperous district, totally destroyed. My grandfather had moved to Tulsa ahead of his wife and two youngest children in 1921 to make a place for them. And his rooming house, his offices, were all destroyed. We acquired a document that my grandfather wrote 10 years later in 1931. We acquired the document last year with the assistance of friends, and it is now part of the museum, as well as two photographs that we acquired at the same time, one of my grandfather's law office in Ardmore, Oklahoma, in 1910, and one of my grandfather and his law partner, I.H. Speer, and their new secretary, Miss Effie Thompson, practicing law June 6th, just 5 days after the massacre, in a Red Cross tent. Miss Thompson had owned, with her husband, the drugstore at the corner, but as it was destroyed and she needed employment, she agreed to be my grandfather and his law partner's secretary. So we have that image saved and part of the collection. In the museum, the National Museum of African American History collection, History and Culture, there is an exhibition called The Power of Place, which Paul Gardullo, the curator, created to create a sense of the regional variation in the African American experience. And he tells 10 different stories, different in time and place, one of which is the story of Black Tulsa before, during, and after the massacre, as a story of resilience, because once people built this community and then saw it destroyed, they rebuilt it in the subsequent 5 years. The city council passed an ordinance saying that people had to rebuild with non-flammable materials, and my grandfather, now an attorney since 1907, fought that successfully all the way to the state Supreme Court. And so people were able to rebuild on the land where they had previously had their homes and businesses.
My guest is John Franklin. We are talking about his ancestor. The book is My Life and an Era, the autobiography of Buck Colbert Franklin. And he mentioned the Indian Removal Act, which of course we know was put into place by President Andrew Jackson. He also is so modest he wouldn't tell you that his father was the illustrious historian John Hope Franklin. We remember the book Up From Slavery. Tell us a little about your father.
Well, my father was deeply involved with the museum as well, because he was asked to, by the leadership of the Smithsonian, to chair our scholarly advisory committee, which he did from 2005 to 2009 when he passed away. My father grew up in this household in Oklahoma. He indeed was separated from his father, and he and his mother and youngest sister were separated from my grandfather from the period immediately following the massacre in 1921 until Tulsa was able to rebuild in 1925. So my father then moves from this all-black town of Rentersville to Tulsa just in time for the end of middle school and high school. So he's in Tulsa from 1925 to 1931. He goes off to Fisk, where he meets my mother, Aurelia Whittington Franklin. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And she becomes a librarian, and she goes on to Hampton Library School after Fisk, and he goes on to Harvard and becomes a historian. And his first book is on the free Negro in North Carolina. Mm-hmm. So my mother's from North Carolina, and my father's first book is on North Carolina. And they eventually live in North Carolina, where my mother's a librarian, and my father teaches first at St. Augustine's College, and then at North Carolina Central, and from there he comes here to Howard. And the fall of 47, when he moves here, From Slavery to Freedom, his best-known book, is published, and then he's launched into a very well-known academic career. I'm born while he's teaching here at Howard. My mother is a librarian for the Prince George's Community School System, for Prince George's County School System, and my wife and I came across a letter in her papers last year of when the superintendent of schools of Prince George's County denied her maternity leave when I was on the way, and so after I'm born, she becomes the first librarian at Spingarn. We move to Brooklyn College in 1956, where my father becomes the chair and first chair of a department in a historically white institution. So it makes front page news of the New York Times. We live in New York from 56 to 64, with a year in England, and then he moves on to the University of Chicago, where he stays for 16 years before retiring from there and moving back to North Carolina. So in the course of that time, he writes, I think, about 16 books on various aspects of American history, history of the South, history of African-Americans, and American institutions, particularly in the 18th and 19th century. With my father, we edit my grandfather's autobiography, which my grandfather wrote in the late 50s, early, and up until 1960, and then the manuscript sat until we published it in 1997. There is, as you will see in the exhibition, The Power of Place, my grandfather's typewriter, an image of him working in that Red Cross tent. And when our app is ready, you'll hear me reading this 10-page typescript eyewitness account by my grandfather of the massacre itself.
We cannot conclude this conversation without talking about the Librarian of Congress, Dr. Carla Hayden. Tell us about her.
Well, yes, I think it's important for people to understand that at the beginning of the 20th century, the majority of African-American women were domestic workers. And as they more and more moved into teaching, a new career of African-American women becoming librarians became possible. And Hampton and a number of other schools had library schools. My mother, her sister, and my mother-in-law all became librarians in the late 1930s, early 1940s. My aunt Bertha Whittington Gibbs worked at the Vivian Harsh Collection in Chicago, and Carla Hayden worked alongside her before my aunt retired. The Vivian Harsh Collection was a collection focusing on African-American materials at the Woodson Library. And then Carla Hayden comes to Baltimore and becomes head of the Enoch Pratt Library System. She and I served on the Reginald Lewis Board together. That's when I really get to know her. And she had known my aunt and my father during her Chicago days. This past week, she was sworn in as the first woman and first African-American Librarian of Congress, and only the third professional librarian to be named to that significant post. It was very exciting, and she was warmly welcomed not only by the invited guests, but particularly by the staff, who cheered her after her being sworn in by the Chief Justice on the Lincoln Bible, which her 81-year-old mother held. And it was just a tremendous occasion. Right. But I rushed away from the press preview because I wasn't going to miss Carla swearing in, and then went back to the press preview.
I saw you rushing away, and I didn't even think to ask you where you were going, because and when I saw you later and you said, I went to the swearing in, I said, what? You could have told me you were going. But I am so glad to have seen you there. I'm so glad because we have a history together. And we have traveled together overseas. So we pretty much know each other. And your dear wife, Karen, say hi to her for me.
I shall. I'm so glad that you got a chance to come to the museum. What were your impressions of this new institution in Washington?
Oh, unbelievable. That was not my first time there, because when the National Association of Black Journalists had their convention here in town, and the National Association of Hispanic Journalists combined and had their conferences here, there was a reception there, and I went. And went on a guided tour. And there, John, as you know, there's so much to see. You have to take like days to just go in. It is the outside. I kept sitting out there and trying to figure out what is this material that's used to make the outside. Everything is just so unbelievably well done. I am so impressed. And even though some of the history in there, most of it, is sad because it's about an enslaved people, there are bright moments in those exhibitions. I'm going back several times.
I hope you will, and I hope your listeners will plan to go, as you mentioned earlier, to our website, nmaahc.si.edu, and plan well ahead of time to come. We have time tickets which do not cost you anything, but it's to pace the entry into the building. And it's my understanding that as of now, visitors will be able to schedule visits for November and December, but not for October.
So I learned, yes. It's.
But it's in so much demand, and people have waited for this for so long. There's an exhibition on the concourse level called 100 Years in the Making, because it indeed is our veterans of the Civil War who began agitating for this museum to be built 100 years ago.
Yes.
And I've been at the Smithsonian since 1987 and watched the fits and starts around this project from the first commission in the late 1980s through the second commission, the presidential commission appointed by George W. Bush, which made the recommendation in 2003 that this museum be created under the auspices of the Smithsonian. And so I've been part of the team since then, building the staff, building the collection from zero, getting Congress. Congress had agreed to pay for half of the construction costs, which amounted to $270 million from them, and then the staff had to raise from the private sector corporations and foundations an additional $270 million, which we succeeded in exceeding. And that allowed us to actually pay for the building. But we have been amazed not only by the financial generosity of the American public, but people have taken the treasures from their homes and brought them to the museum. We have a small conference room, and often I'm going in and out of the office, and I'll see a family from children through grandparents handing over their family's treasures to the museum. And Saturday night we had a reception for those who had donated objects, photographs, paintings, their family Bibles.
Nat Turner's Bible, I understand.
Right, yes. And these are not just African-American, because these treasures were in the homes of all kinds of Americans.
Yes.
And when they heard the call for the creation of this museum, they said, well, we've had Nat Turner's Bible in our family since the 19th century. Now it can have a new home at the Smithsonian. Right now we also have an exhibition in American history where we've had a gallery since 2009, and two of Harriet Tubman's objects are on display there, a bow tie, a lace bow tie of hers, and a handkerchief of hers which are two of 39 objects that someone gave to us. Mm-hmm. They inherited them. And they started worrying about what would happen to them. And they called us up and said, would you please take these materials? So the generosity of the American public has just been incredible. Our very first object came from an Afro-Ecuadorian anthropologist who heard about the museum, and he was headed to the United States and brought the stool that belonged to his grandmother and mother to us as our first gift. Mm. And in the seat of the stool, it has a spider web and a spider. And Juan Garcia told the Anansi the spider stories he grew up knowing as a child, represented by the spider and the spider web on the stool. So it helped our director, Lonnie Bunch, understand from the beginning that the story is international.
Yes.
And
the press that came in for Media Day was international. I mean,
yes,
people came from all over the world to be there. John Franklin, Director of Partnership and International Programs at Smithsonian Institution's National Museum of African American History and Culture. Thank you so much for joining me. And we should also send kudos out to Congressman John Lewis, because he fought long and hard on the Hill to get legislation to make this happen. We'll talk soon.
Thanks so much for this opportunity.
All right, dear. Take care.